All right.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning, all you magnificent melonheads of the world, and happy Friday, everybody. Today is May 15th, 2026. And this just in, we interrupt a bunch of drunks aimlessly bidding up stock prices to bring you a global bond sell-off. Oh, that's a nice way to end the week. Got interest rates are spiking across the world. Not a huge spike, but big enough and at levels high enough to make investors notice this morning. The U.S. 10-year yield is at 4.55%, up almost 10 points this morning, higher than we have been since last May. Hey, that's right around the time Trump started his first pause on the tariffs and then the series of consecutive 90-day punts and deals, no deals, and that whole silly exercise from last year. Yeah, we're back to that level. The UK, their 10-year gilt, higher by 17 basis points this morning. The Japanese interest rates also rising by large levels relative to the Japanese bond market. Japanese interest rates are notoriously low, so to see them moving up even a couple of basis points is a big move for Japanese bonds. So what's going on here? Why are bonds selling off across the world? Why is it getting more expensive for governments to borrow? It's oil, it's Iran, it's energy. All right, the reality is setting in. Inflation is making a comeback. We saw it. CPI came in higher than expected, slightly higher than expected this week. Then PPI came in sharply higher than expected. I mean, people were just blown away. I could not believe my eyes when I saw the PPI numbers. And look, I get it. You know, guys, inflation is always higher than the government statistics will admit. But to see the government statistics move like that, understand the significance of what we saw in PPI on Wednesday. That was a shocking number. And I'm kind of amazed it's taken the bond market 2 days to react the way it has. It should have been right away. We've also seen other local headlines, like India had a producer price inflation number yesterday that we talked about that was shockingly higher than expected. So, you know, the market is coming to grips this morning with the reality that the Federal Reserve's next move is going to be a rate hike, not a rate cut. That is setting in. You can see it in the CME rate futures. And then also locally, you've got some things going on in the UK and Japan, particularly, that are adding to those problems. You've got political instability in the UK. Keir Starmer is hanging on to the prime minister's office by a thread. He's probably not going to last longer. The higher the bond market move, or the higher the bond yields move, the more likely it is he gets forced out. And then also you've got in Japan, they're talking again about more government spending programs and stimmies to offset inflation. By the way, that's not how that works. That never works. Government stimmies do not help with inflation. They make it worse. People just don't seem to get that. The academics can't seem to get that through their heads. The Keynesians refuse to admit it, despite empirical data, a mountain of such to the contrary. Japanese stimmies, that's contributing to the rise there. I mean, and look, stocks are reacting to that this morning. Stock prices have gone ballistic for the last 2 months, inexplicably so. I don't know if it's just a big gamma squeeze, a bunch of trust me, bro, going on in the AI space, the memory shortages. But debt getting more expensive, it's going to make all that money they're borrowing to build all that crap that nobody wants and nobody needs except other tech bros. It's going to get a lot more expensive to borrow and build that stuff. So sooner or later, that's going to spill over into stocks, and the market's reacting appropriately this morning for once. We've also got a lot of oil headlines going on here. The United Arab Emirates is building a second major west to east pipeline to the port of Fujairah to bypass the Strait of Hormuz. That's supposed to be completed in 2027. They're shifting the infrastructure to plan around the eventuality of extended disruptions in the Strait of Hormuz. Also, there's an article about the UAE that they had tried to coordinate a military response with Saudi Arabia and Qatar in particular when the Iranians were attacking them following the American and Israeli bombing of Iran. And the Saudis and Qataris pretty much said it's not our war, even though missiles were landing on their own heads. And that decision, the UAE decided to participate in the bombing, at least on a limited basis. The UAE military isn't that big. But it was that decision by the Saudis and the Qataris to not respond militarily that precipitated the UAE leaving OPEC, which was a really surprising thing that happened about 2 weeks ago now. Geopolitical shift underway in the Middle East. I think that will be playing out for years in the future here. Also, some more details on that ship that was seized by Iran off the coast of the UAE yesterday. We had talked about the UK MTO had released that a vessel had been seized and was heading towards Iran. Get this. It was a Chinese floating armory for maritime security forces. What the hell, man? Look, maritime security forces, that's a new thing because of piracy and because of the Iranian attacks on boats. A lot of ships have armed security on board. So I guess I'm not too surprised to see a maritime armory for security forces, but it's Chinese. And the Chinese and the Iranians were supposedly, up until a few days ago anyway, playing really nice in the sandbox. And then remember, we had that story a couple days ago about the Iranians seizing a boat carrying their own oil. It was a Chinese vessel carrying Iranian oil that the Iranians seized. Probably, I'm guessing now, because the Chinese refused to pay the extortion toll to get out of the Strait of Hormuz. We had some sound bites to that effect at the largely nothing burger Trump Xi meeting. Really, the only takeaway that surprised me from that whole episode was Xi Jinping saying, we agree there shouldn't be a toll booth in the Strait of Hormuz. That was somewhat the Chinese giving the middle finger to the Iranians. And then, yeah, the Iranians take their armory boat. So maybe the Chinese and the Iranians not getting along so well. Or maybe the Chinese just put a bunch of missiles on a boat and said, here's our armory boat. You think an armory boat would be very well protected. And then the Iranians took it. So maybe it was just a backdoor way to arm Iran. But I think it was largely small arms were probably on board this boat if it was maritime security forces. It's not like they carry anti-ship missiles. But yeah, that's a messy story going on this morning. Blackstone and KKR, their private credit funds, have taken ownership of the dental practice called Affordable Care. That's a company that does out-of-pocket dental implants. Basically, people without insurance having their teeth replaced, which based on the current status of the U.S. consumer and the economic conditions on Main Street, is pretty much freaking nobody is paying for fake teeth out of pocket right now. People are going without teeth, probably. What stage is that? This company, this private dental practice, Affordable Care, it was bought by private equity in 2021 for $2.7 billion. And they bought it with a private credit loan of $1.4 billion. So, okay, on the surface, hey, look, our loan-to-value ratio is super low, just 52%. We've got a great big cushion, blah, blah, blah. All that bullshit that the private credit companies tell us about how, don't worry, the LTVs are low and we're safe and everything. Yeah, well, 70% of that loan just got wiped out. And the private equity firms handed the keys off to the private credit lenders who are taking a bath on this deal. This is just a reminder, in private credit, the marks are completely made up. And when it comes time to actually sell these loans or sell these assets, they're not worth anywhere near what they claim. And so private credit taking another bath, guys. We are going to hear those headlines about private credit redemption requests being sky high. They will be coming back within the next few weeks or so. Also, we got to talk about this one. President Trump's stock trades. And look, I had some people reacted rather strongly in the comments. I try not to get too political on this channel. Sometimes it can't be helped. Let me just preface this. A lot of people said yesterday that I was suffering from TDS when I said that the Trump Xi meeting could have been an email. No, I stand by that headline, which, by the way, was hilarious. Mish, that was very good. Mish came up with that one yesterday. I can't take credit for it. No, I don't suffer from Trump derangement syndrome. I voted for the guy three times, all right? People who voted for Trump three times don't have TDS, all right? And I voted for him begrudgingly because I just don't like communism. I'm not a MAGA guy. I'm not a, like, Trumper, all right? But I can tell you my own political biases. I lean conservative quite heavily, you probably figured out. That being said, President Trump's stock trades are freaking gross. This story broke yesterday. Trump made dozens of stock trades personally, in a $1 to $5 million range, including a lot of tech companies that overlapped with policy decisions he was making at the same time he was making those trades. That is freaking disgusting, a sitting president doing that. If you're not okay with Nancy Pelosi's stock tracker with congressional insiders trading based on bills going through Congress, then you should not be okay with this. This is freaking gross. What is going on? The financial grift. And again, guys, I'm not a TDSer. I voted for the guy. It's getting worse under him. It is not getting better. It is getting much freaking worse. We need higher standards. I don't have the solutions. I don't know how to fix it. I'm not about to vote for a communist because of it, but it freaking smells disgusting and I can't keep my mouth shut. Okay, moving on from that. Supreme Court, major decision from the Supreme Court handed down. Freight brokers can now be sued for lack of due diligence resulting in trucking accidents. And we got some information from Craig Fuller that he posted on Twitter. That's going to make transport a lot more expensive at a time when diesel prices are already sky high because of, you know, the whole inflation Iran war thing. Very significant development on the highways that is going to result in probably higher prices. So we got that going for us. Oh, good. Guys, we got a lot to talk about this morning. Why don't we shrink my big melon of a head and let's see what's going on in the world of finance. And don't forget that like button and that subscribe button for the YouTube algorithm so you can come back tomorrow or Saturday. Don't come back tomorrow. Tomorrow's Saturday. We don't do this on Saturday, but we do it every business day. So I'll see you guys on Monday. Right now, the S&P 500 is lower by 86 points, 1.15% in the red. The Dow is down 455 points, 0.91% in the red this morning. And look at the NASDAQ down almost 500 points here, 1.67% lower. Again, let's put that in perspective. The NASDAQ is in the middle of a freaking blow-off top. And like, oh, that's just a reminder. Stocks are capable of going down like one out of every 25 days, apparently. But yeah, down big this morning. And we'll get to the bond market in just a minute. That is the big driver of this. We've got a stronger dollar as well, 99.22, higher by 34 basis points. Big move in the dollar to go along with those higher interest rates. Oh, no, that can't be good for gold. We're going to have to talk about that one in just a minute. But first, Bitcoin is holding up surprisingly well. We've got a big risk-off move going on here. And I guess risk-off, yeah. I don't know what this is just a sell-off. You got everything is being sold off right now except dollars. I guess you could call that risk off. But Bitcoin is holding up all right here, down $724, still above 80,000, currently sitting $80,354. Of all the assets in the world, Bitcoin appears to be holding up the best during a bond market rout. Guys, there's a lot of things, a lot of historical correlations and relationships that just don't work anymore. I don't know what the hell is going on here. You'd think Bitcoin would be down $2,000 or $3,000 on a global bond market route, but no, it's down $700. Looking over at the commodities board, as I suspected, gold is down sharply this morning, $100 in the red, $4,550 off by 2.2% here. Spot silver, ooh, brutal day in silver, down $6.05. Still at $77.44, which is a highly respectable number. I mean, up until about a year ago, we would have been celebrating and high-fiving each other for $77, but that's down sharply, 7.16% lower this morning. Again, stronger dollar, higher interest rates, not good for precious metals. But you know what? I still like the shiny long-term. I don't invest in silver for short-term price moves. I invest in silver for long-term wealth preservation. Copper is off by 5%. Copper has had a heck of a run along with tech stocks over these last couple of weeks. Platinum down 4.8%, palladium down 1.8%, and crude oil is moving higher here. WTI crude is at $104.39. Guys, I'm seeing a lot of reports about uranium maybe off the table on the as far as negotiations. It sounds like both President Trump and the Iranian delegation are starting to tacitly agree to take the enriched uranium out of the Strait of Hormuz discussion, which has been a big Iranian demand this whole time. You'd think oil would be dropping on that, but it isn't. So I don't know if these are just unconfirmed, anonymously sourced reports, which is why I'm not going to talk too much about them. But you would think oil would be down on some of that uranium talk this morning, but it's not. It's up by 3%. Let's take a look at that chart, by the way. Once again, oil rejecting the 50-day moving average, acting as support. We've seen that a couple of times now. So oil, the uptrend is intact. We'll see where we close for the day. This, by the way, we're soaring 99.85. I just saw 104 when I looked here. Okay, there's something. We got a disconnect between TradingView and the Investing.com futures. But I tend to go with Investing.com. It tends to be more accurate. Yeah, there it is. All right, let's go over to the looking at the bond market here. This was the big one. 30-year yield. Look at that. Up 8.5 points. 5.099 for the 30-year. The 10-year yield up almost 11 basis points. 10.9 points higher. 4.566. Highest we've seen in a year. The 2-year yield, 4.07, up 8 basis points. The 1 month is actually down a fraction of a point here at 3.661%. All right, so let's look at what's going on in the bond market here. We've got this one that summarizes it pretty well in Bloomberg. Global bond sell-off worsens as rising oil prices spook investors. Investors shed government bonds around the world, propelling borrowing costs to multi-year highs from Japan to the U.S. amid intensifying fears that war-driven inflation will force central banks to pursue higher interest rates. In the U.S., the yield on the 2-year treasuries climbed to 4.06, a level not seen since March of 2025. Japan's 30-year yield hit 4% for the first time since 1999, and a political crisis in the U.K. lifted 30-year gilt yields to a 28-year high. Let's see. While bond yields gradually moved higher in recent days, the sell-off gathered pace on Friday, with yields in Germany, Spain, Australia, and New Zealand also pushing up. Investors were also beginning to sound alarm bells that higher borrowing costs may even puncture the recent run-up in equities. Oh, don't let those higher debt costs slow you down in your $300 billion AI debt bender that the hyperscalers are currently engaged in. Remember, money is no object to these companies. They don't care how much they're spending. They don't care how much it costs them to borrow it. That's just something for shareholders at a later date to worry about. And worry they will. But for now, where's my stonks, bro? In Japan, the rise in yields also reflects renewed concern over the nation's fiscal policy. A report in Kyoto News said the government is weighing an extra budget to fund relief measures for the economy. Finance Minister Satsuki Katayama later said that the situation had not yet reached the point where that's needed. All right, so we got stimmy talk in Japan, who is a money printer gone wild. I can see that driving up borrowing costs. In Japan, where interest rates have been near zero for a long time, the fact that the yield on their 30-year JGB has risen to 4% is historic, said Rinto Maruyama, senior FX and rate strategist at SMBC Nikko Securities. Again, that 4% number doesn't seem like it's that high nominally, but relative to where Japan was a few years ago at nothing point nothing, even negative at times, 4% is astronomically high on a relative basis. This suggests the possibility of sustained inflation in Japan, which has long been plagued by deflation. We've got for the U.S., inflation is the overwhelming risk facing the economy, Fed Governor Michael Barr said on Thursday. The comments followed data this week that showed producer costs accelerating at the fastest pace since 2022. Traders are pricing in an almost two-thirds chance that the Fed will hike interest rates in December, according to data compiled by Bloomberg. That's a little bit higher than I'm seeing in the CME futures, but still the predominance is that they're probably going to hike. Concern about embedded inflation is spreading, said Kenneth Crompton, head of rate strategy at National Australia Bank in Sydney. Meanwhile, the UK has been gripped by a brewing leadership contest that could usher in more public spending. The bond sell-off was kicked into gear on Friday by signs that Manchester Mayor Andy Burnham may have a path to challenge Prime Minister Keir Starmer. So you've got UK gilt yields are rising. Okay, so let's take a look at it. This is interesting. The 10-year yield in the U.S., again, big move higher here, currently higher by almost 10 basis points, 4.564. We've been rising all week. The one thing I would note, the last time we were at this level was May of 2025, Wednesday, the 21st of May, to be precise. But I also want to zoom way back on this chart because we've got this consolidation pattern that we've been in for a while, and I've been highlighting this. We are now at the upper band of this. Now, we have historically rejected this level. We had the punt on the tariffs, and this was that Bill Ackman high from October of 2023 when Bill Ackman announced that he was covering his short on U.S. Treasuries, and that was basically the peak in the 10-year, almost to the day. And now we are here, all right? So, look, these patterns, these triangle patterns, you could break in either direction, but we're threatening to break to the upside right now, and I continue to believe that this red line here around COVID marks the beginning of a new era of longer, higher for longer interest rates, sharply higher. And I think the era of ZIRP and BRRRR is behind us, even though they keep trying to fight the current war using the last war's weapons of just lower rates and print money. The Fed is currently involved in QE, even though they're calling it, what, reserve management purchases. Yeah, you're printing money and buying bonds with it. it's causing higher inflation. That and, you know, the whole thing's blowing up in the Middle East. Now, let's talk about the Fed here, because right now, this is the odds of what the Fed's target rate will be come December. And right now, there's only a 52% chance that the Fed does nothing. You'll notice here, 350 to 375 as the Fed's target rate. That's where we're currently at. And there's no bars to the left of that, which means there is no chance as of right now that the Federal Reserve cuts for the rest of the year. No chance. So, you know, if you're piling into tech stocks because my Fed rate cuts, you got another thing coming here, according to CME Futures. We got a 38% chance that they actually hike rates now, and even a 9% chance that they hike twice. And a couple of guys are over here flirting with three hikes this year. It's pretty obvious that the next move the Fed makes, if any, will be to hike interest rates. And the market is not positioned right now for a Fed tightening cycle, not even close. Looking over at the UK gilt market, that's also moving up sharply higher here, 12, 13 basis points higher at 5.162. This has been moving steadily higher, and it's been accelerating for these last few weeks, especially since the war in Iran started. I want to zoom out here, guys, because it was back in, 2022 that I circled this. This is when Prime Minister Liz Truss was forced to resign because of higher interest rates. And now here we are sharply higher than that level. And in Japan, up and to the right. We've been doing it all year, but I would note that we are accelerating up and to the right. We've got a noticeable acceleration just in the last week here as inflation is picking up steam, actually showing up in the official data, not just worries about higher oil prices and pain at the pump, PPI and CPI data actually showing those higher prices. And we are seeing bond markets react strongly to that. Now they're talking about stimmies to offset in a country that's just been plagued by money printing, Japan. So yeah, the bond market's reacting strongly to that. And again, 2.7% up from nothing just a few years ago. Borrowing costs getting a lot more expensive. One of these days, we're going to be talking about that yen carry trade again. All right, now let's shift gears a little bit from the bond market sell-off to what's going on in the Middle East. The UAE fast-tracks a second west-to-east oil pipeline to bypass the Strait of Hormuz. Abu Dhabi's accelerating construction of the new west-east pipeline to Fujairah as it looks to expand its oil export capacity and bypass the Strait of Hormuz choke point. The project, expected to come online in 2027, will double the Abu Dhabi National Oil Company, or ADNOC's, export capacity. Before the war, the UAE was producing just over 3 million barrels per day, broadly in line with OPEC plus targets. Abu Dhabi has targeted a capacity to produce 4.9 million barrels per day. And now, due to the war, the UAE is producing between 1.8 and 2.1 million barrels per day. So this new west-east pipeline should accelerate that, but it's going to take about a year to build. And we've got another interesting development here geopolitically, and it looks like this was a major contributor to why the UAE left OPEC. UAE tried in vain to get Saudis to coordinate on Iran response. The United Arab Emirates tried to persuade neighboring states, including Saudi Arabia and Qatar, to take part in a coordinated military response to Iran strikes, and was left frustrated when they refused, according to people familiar with the matter. UAE President Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed held a series of calls with fellow leaders, including Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, shortly after the U.S. and Israel began bombing Iran on February 28th, said the people who asked not to be identified. MBZ, as the UAE president is known, was convinced of the need to retaliate as a group to deter Iran. That's what the people said, as the Islamic Republic responded to U.S.-Israeli attacks by firing hundreds of drones and missiles at Gulf countries. Tehran targeted ports and airports, as well as residential towers and hotels across the region. Iran also all but closed the vital Strait of Hormuz. While NBC quickly opted to work with U.S. President Trump's administration and the Israelis, his Gulf Arab counterparts told him this wasn't their war, according to one person familiar with Abu Dhabi's thinking. An already fractious relationship between the UAE and Saudi Arabia worsened as a result. During the calls, UAE president reminded his counterparts that the Gulf Cooperation Council, a six-country body, was founded in 1981 specifically because of threats posed to them by Iran's Islamic Revolution 2 years previous. The previously unreported details help explain the UAE's anger with fellow Arab states, culminating in its momentous decision to leave OPEC in late April, as well as its closer relations with Israel. The UAE carried out limited attacks against Iran without Gulf support starting in early March and again in April, people familiar with the matter said. Again, the UAE, some of their ties with Israel, we talked about it in weeks ago, like Israeli military advisors operating Iron Dome and Iron Beam batteries in the UAE. The UAE allowing that, that was a momentous shift in their position and their attitude towards Israel. Then them leaving OPEC, arms deals that are going on with the U.S. Geopolitical alliances are in flux at the moment. Everything has been thrown into chaos by this war. Alliances are shifting. UAE is undergoing quite a change here. And I remember when they arrested Daniel Kinahan, I said that is significant because they had been hiding him for years, allowing him to live his flamboyant lifestyle out in the open in Dubai. And well, you know, when Iranian drones and missiles are landing on your head, suddenly you're not so willing to shelter an Iranian money launderer. It's funny how that works. Meanwhile, we've got this one in Ynet. Iran seizes floating armory near Hormuz as Trump says China promised not to arm Tehran. This is kind of interesting. There's two different ways you could look at this story. The BBC reported that a ship seized near the Strait of Hormuz served as a floating armory for maritime security firms as Iran opened the waterway to Chinese ships during Trump's China visit, and Saudi Arabia reportedly pursued a non-aggression pact with Tehran. All right, so they're kind of hinting at it in the headlines. This floating armory was seized as China promised not to arm Tehran. Well, they kind of just armed Tehran, didn't they, by having their boat seized. Did the Chinese allow the boat to get seized? Is that how they're getting the arms in now? Being like, well, we just put it there and the Iranians took it. It's not our fault. That's one way to look at it. Or you could look at it as the Iranians are pissed that the Chinese are opposed to their toll booth and that the Chinese are, you know, not helping them more. You know, they publicly promised not to arm Tehran. Maybe the Iranians are just pissed about that. I don't know what's going on here. But that's significant, and this all comes just a few weeks after Iran seized a Chinese vessel carrying Iranian oil, I suspect because that vessel refused to pay the extortion fee. And so, again, a lot of geopolitical things are in flux this morning, guys. Meanwhile, India raises retail fuel prices for the first time since the Iran war started. You've got very strict price controls on fuel in India, and the fact that they're raising them, even a token amount, is significant here. India's state-run fuel retailers have raised petrol and diesel prices for the first time in 4 years by 3 rupees, which is about 3 cents per liter. Boo-hoo, cry me a river, by the way. Anybody living in California saying, hold my beer. But that is more than 3% increase, allowing the dealers to recoup some of the losses incurred due to higher crude oil prices. Again, you've got very strict price controls in India, so this seems like a token amount, especially as we've watched gas prices go up by more than a dollar a gallon here in the States, 3 cents per liter, who cares? But remember, those price controls do lead to shortages, and you can kind of get at that towards the bottom of this article here. Fuel austerity steps to curb fuel consumption and rein in oil import bills. New Delhi has rolled out austerity measures as policymakers brace for a prolonged energy shock. Fuel austerity measures, that means rationing is pretty much what they're talking about. On Sunday, Prime Minister Narendra Modi urged a spate of measures, including fuel conservation, work from home practices, and limits on travel and imports, as surging global energy prices put pressure on the country's foreign exchange reserves. That's also why the Prime Minister told people not to buy gold, and then they doubled their tariffs on gold. Trying to get Indians not to buy gold is a futile gesture, but they are serious about defending their currency because of this energy shortage. Some states have issued notices to government departments this week to restrict travel, avoid physical events, and shift meetings online, while also asking them to work from home 2 days a week with offices half-staffed. Oh, look, oil lockdowns. Is that what we've got going on here? Well, that's fun. India is likely to widen the measure to cover millions of employees across the federal government, state-run banks, and public sector firms, signaling a system-wide tightening of expenditure and operations as financial risks mount. Price controls, shortages, rationing going on, oil lockdowns. We've even got Hungary taps strategic fuel reserves amid market turbulence. Another country tapping their oil reserves. They're talking about 575 million liters of fuel, trying to make it sound a lot. It's like 3.5 million barrels of oil they're releasing, but Hungary's not that big of an economy. So it's just another example of countries tapping their reserves. Also, I would add that Hungary has a pre-existing oil crisis that predates the Iran war. Remember, there was the Russians pipeline. The Russians blew up the pipeline through Ukraine that fed Hungary oil. And previous President Orban had released oil from their reserves in order to offset that. There was a lot of consternation between Hungary and Ukraine. The Hungarians accused the Ukrainians of dragging their feet on the repairs because Orban was a notoriously Russia-friendly president. Orban is now out of there. You got the new guy Magyar has taken over. And then you've got the Iran war on top of that pipeline that was damaged. So Hungary is dumping their fuel reserves as well as this energy shock continues to ripple across the world. Meanwhile, we've got Blackstone and KKR take over dental firm after slashing 70% debt. And this article summarizes why all of the arguments the private credit industry are making right now are just complete bullshit. When you look at the numbers and the marks and the losses that are stacking up here, this is really staggering. And it's for a company that does out-of-pocket dental replacements. Like, who the heck has money to replace their own teeth for cash? If you don't have dental insurance, it's probably because you're broke, and that means you're probably not able to afford a dental implant. This was a stupid idea to buy this company at a time when stimmy cash was flooding the world. Direct lenders, including Blackstone and KKR, are set to take control of struggling dental business Affordable Care and slash about 70% of the debt as part of a restructuring agreement, according to a person familiar with the matter. Lenders are set to receive a pro rata share of $225 million of first lien, second out term loan, $200 million of payment in kind notes. Oh, I love that payment in kind. That's where we just make the debt bigger instead of actually paying it back. And 100% of the pro forma equity, the person familiar said, asking not to be identified, discussing private information. So they're getting about $425 million of in some form of payment. The creditors who invested in the $1.4 billion private credit loan are also being offered the opportunity to participate in a $75 million new money loan. Oh, if you like the 70% haircut you just took on that $1.4 billion private credit loan, we'd like to offer you an opportunity to lend us even more money. Is that something you might be interested in? Oh, no, don't hit me. Sorry, jeez, just offered. Instruments ranking lower than the senior loan in the payment waterfall, including equity and preferred shares, would be fully wiped out, according to a separate person with knowledge of the matter. In other words, the private equity firms who bought this company lose everything. They're just turning over the keys. The deal is being finalized, set to close by the end of next month. Blackstone and KKR have been the creditors leading the restructuring, Bloomberg previously reported. Antares Capital and New Mountain Capital were also part of the discussions. Blackstone holds the largest portion of the company's senior debt in its Blackstone Private Credit Fund, known as BCRED. They had previously slashed the value of the Affordable Care loans to 70 cents on the dollar as of the end of March. Well, you're going to have to cut that even more now because you're only getting back 30 cents on the dollar plus worthless equity. It's just another example that the marks are bullshit. All right. They said this was worth 70 cents on the dollar a month and a half ago, and now it's 30%. 30 cents on the dollar. Obviously, they're just making these marks up and they're nowhere near reality. And this is why everything the private credit industry tells you about everything is fine. Trust me, bro. It's just not real. Let's see. The firm first marked down the loan 18 months ago. They continue to be proactive in addressing underperformers across their portfolio. Yeah, okay. Private equity firms Harvest Partners and Berkshire Partners are Affordable Care's majority backers. When Harvest Partners bought its stake in 2021, the company was valued at $2.7 billion. All right, so that says a lot right there. $2.7 billion they paid for this company. This was in 2021 with all the stimmy cash and everybody overpaying for assets because Burr. And now they borrowed $1.4 billion. Okay, $1.4 billion out of $2.7 billion valuation. It's only a 52% LTV. The loan-to-value ratios are low. This is safe debt. Nope, because the valuation was bloated. And then even recently when they valued the debt, that valuation was bloated because the marks are just completely made up. Affordable Care is exclusively focused on tooth replacement solutions, serving affiliated dentists at 425 practices in about 40 states across the U.S. Yeah, guys, the problems in private credit, they're not over. They're just beginning. And we got to talk about this one. This one's gross. I feel like I need to take a shower after I read this article. Trump traded NVIDIA, Boeing, Intel in flurry of transactions. President Donald Trump's latest financial disclosures show that he made a slew of stock and bond purchases with major American companies in the first quarter of the year, totaling in the tens of millions of dollars and possibly more. The transactions spelled out in the documents filed with the U.S. Office of Government Ethics that encompass more than 100 pages, of financial disclosures. Okay, well, let's talk about one of those pages. List purchases and sales in broad ranges. In the first quarter, the president bought between $1 and $5 million in NVIDIA, Oracle, Microsoft, Boeing, Costco, and here's Midnight's tail. Midnight just jumped up on my hair. Say hi, buddy. There he is. This is the guy who's always attacking my feet while I'm live. Okay, buddy, we're in the middle of a show. We got to talk about this one. All right. Now, where was I? It's not clear how many of the transactions involve equities. Unlike reports that members of Congress file, Trump doesn't have to specify the classes of the assets he's trading. The president has made a number of policy moves that intersect with publicly traded companies, including NVIDIA, whose chips critical to AI deployment require U.S. government approval for foreign sales. Oh, didn't he just bring NVIDIA's CEO on Air Force One to China? Didn't he just fly him over there to try to sell chips to the Chinese? Executives from NVIDIA and Boeing are part of a U.S. delegation of business leaders who have accompanied Trump on a trip to China this week. Guys, this is not Trump derangement syndrome. I'm not some lefty lunatic. I voted for the guy several times. This is freaking disgusting. This should not be allowed. Congress shouldn't do it. President shouldn't do it. It's gross. He's buying millions of dollars in shares in publicly traded companies before making decisions that drive those values higher. That is, by definition, insider trading. Shouldn't be allowed. But you know what? We live in the era of immunity and blanket pardons and Midnight's on my lap again. And so I guess we just have to let this one go. All right, last one of the day. The Supreme Court just told every freight broker that they can be sued. Shout out to Freight Waves and my friend Craig Fuller, who broke this story yesterday. This is big. This could be a mess for truck drivers. The Supreme Court of the United States has handed down its decision in Montgomery versus Caribe this morning. It was unanimous, 9-0. All right. This was not a case of one side's judges leaning. Everybody on the court sided, voted this way. Justice Amy Coman Barrett wrote the opinion. Justice Brett Kavanaugh filed a concurrence, joined by Justice Samuel Alito, saying the case was closer than the majority opinion suggested, but agreeing with the result. A negligent hiring claim against a freight broker is not preempted by the Federal Aviation Administration's Authorization Act. All right, there's a whole bunch of legalese here. What does this mean? It means if a trucker kills somebody on the road, the freight broker who hired that trucker could be found negligent and liable if he didn't make reasonable efforts to determine that that driver was safe, that that carrier had a good safety records. There's no legal infrastructure in place to determine that. They're just saying you have to. The question a jury will now be permitted to ask in every state in America is whether the broker exercised reasonable care in selecting the carrier. That means, did you check the carrier's safety record? Was the carrier's FMCSA data available to you? Did the data show elevated crash rates, conditional safety ratings, high out-of-service percentages, or prior enforcement history? Did you have a documented process for evaluating carrier safety, or did you book the cheapest truck and move on? If you're a freight broker operating in the U.S. today, the preemption defense you have been relying on since 2023, when the Seventh Circuit decided Yee versus Global Trans, is now gone. You are now subject to state tort law in every jurisdiction where you arrange transportation. The carrier you select, the safety record you ignore, the data you decline to check, all of it is discoverable. All of it is admissible. All of it can be presented to a jury. So if you're a freight broker in the United States now, you have got to verify that your carrier is not going to kill somebody. There's no legal definition of how you do that. So the industry is going to have to get together and establish some kind of in-house regulatory body and a standard that the brokers are going to be expected to follow, and a process for document how they're following that standard. That's the only way I can see them getting out of this. But this is going to make trucks more expensive, guys. I mean, this is, the brokers are going to have to get more insurance now. They're going to have more red tape that they're going to have to follow. This is going to drive up costs. And look, the reason they're doing this is because during the truck driver shortage during COVID, they gave CDLs to every Tom, Dick, Harry, Habib, and Jamal that was out there, and you got a whole bunch of people who don't even freaking speak English, can't read the road signs, are out there driving big rigs, and they're killing people. Accident rates are through the roof. And so now they're saying the brokers who are hiring these people because they're willing to work less than safe truck drivers, they could be held liable for that. And that makes sense because, you know, the families who are suing carriers who aren't even carrying freaking insurance in some cases, and there's like nobody they can sue, they're trying to sue the brokers, and the brokers were hiding behind this old FAA law. Now the Supreme Court says, no, you're on the hook too. And Craig Fuller says truck spot rates surged to $357 a mile, approaching an all-time high of $368 a mile set during the New Year's Eve holiday in 2021-2022. This is up 47 cents a mile from a week ago. Diesel is only 1 cent a mile higher than it was a week ago. So you can see the situation, freight getting much more expensive. Now, look, it's been happening for a while because of the Iran war, because fuel costs have been going up. Also, you've got the capacity crackdown that's been ongoing. That's been driving up trucking rates. But this decision is causing another spike on top of all that, nearly an all-time high. And also, the rejection rate is surging. This is also from Craig Fuller on X. Sonar truckload rejection surged to a new cycle high of 15.44%. Capacity is as tight as it's been in years. And, well, I suspect the Supreme Court decision is going to drive up that rejection rate as well. So what's the takeaway from this, guys? It's going to get more expensive to move things. And it's already getting more expensive to move things because fuel prices keep going up. You can see it in that ridiculously high PPI report that we got earlier this week. You can see it in the Fed rate hike expectations that are building up. The bond market can see all of this stuff now. Borrowing costs are getting more expensive. And that's why stocks are down today. The bond market and the stock market are singing two wildly different tunes over the last few weeks. And well, the bond market usually wins in the long run. Was the famous quote from James Carville. He said, when he dies, he wants to be reincarnated as the bond market because the bond market intimidates everyone. Well, I just want to say thank you guys for having your coffee with the Melonheads this morning. Don't forget that like button and that subscribe button for the YouTube algorithm. Thank you very much to my Patreon supporters on YouTube, Patreon, and Buy Me Coffee. It's Friday. That means 2 p.m. Eastern time today. We'll be getting together for our weekly Q&A on Zoom. Links down below should you feel so inclined. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. Love you guys. Everybody, till next time, live small and dream big.